All right, well, let's pray and get started. So, Lord, we ask you for a spirit of wisdom and revelation today. We ask you that you would unfold the mystery of the Gospels, the fullness of the Gentiles to our hearts today. Father, that you would give us a heart like your heart, a desiring that all the nations would be saved before the day of the Lord, Father. That it wouldn't just be dry information, but would be pertinent and useful to our hearts expanding, identifying with you, Father. We ask you for your Holy Spirit today in the name of Jesus. Amen. So, a little bit of review. The purpose for the class kind of being summed up in a number of places, but Romans 11, I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers, so you may not be conceited. Israel experienced a hardening in part until the fullness or full number of the Gentiles has come in. So really, the study of church and missions history in summary, is a study of the Lord's unfolding of the fullness of the Gentiles to come in before the day of the Lord. And so we've looked at four primary ages of thus far of the Gentiles, the Roman age involving primarily Gentile peoples within the Roman Empire, and then also within the Persian Empire during the first 500 years. And then we looked at the Germanic Age and the fall of the Roman Empire and the German tribes coming in, and then coming out of Ireland, the re-evangelization of Europe and the evangelization of the Roman peoples, and then out of the Persian Empire, that stretching across Turkmenistan and into China and down into India during the Germanic Age. And then at the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, you had a real push also into Russia after the schism and the Eastern Orthodox. So you had three really movements within the church. After the schism, you had the Far Eastern, the Assyrian church, and then you had the Eastern Orthodox church, and then you had the Western Roman church. And during the European age, as I call it, you have really a centering of the church around Europe, and you have a dying out to a large extent of the church in the East, and which sets the stage for kind of the age of discovery centered in Europe, coming out of Europe. You have the rise of two major missionary organizations, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, right about the time that you have the beginning of the Crusades in Europe, when you had in my mind, the application of the theology of the church at that time, because really the Crusades are the logical application of theology of the manifest kingdom and the church being led by the Pope, the Vicar of Christ on earth. And so you kind of have the logical outworking of that, because the Crusades really were, I mean, if you take the theology of, for example, Innocent III around 1200, and Innocent really pushed that he was the authority not only in the spiritual realm, but also in the physical realm, and that his authority in the spiritual realm dictated that he had authority over all the nations in the physical realm. And really, the papacy really did not only say that in words, but the Crusades were kind of an outworking of that, a logical outworking of that. So you had a number of people, which that whole mindset really led to a number of abuses and corruption. You had a number of reformers rise up in the late medieval ages, and then you had the Italian Renaissance after the Black Plague, in which you had a revival of Roman, Greco-Roman culture and thought and lifestyle. And so in that context, you had the Reformation rise up, which was kind of, I kind of view it as something that was inevitable to happen during that time based on the cultural movement against the traditional governmental structures of the time. Though it obviously there were some things that particularly needed to happen. The way it played out was ineffective in a number of ways. And basically you just ended up with two structures after the Reformation that were analogous in the way they functioned. And generally they had some different ideas, but as far as broad spectrum, their worldview, you had two structures that were basically the same, the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, as far as generally the way they thought, though there are particular things that were different, but generally the way they thought and the way they functioned, the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church really functioned the same way. And it wasn't until you had Puritanism and Pietism after the Thirty Years' War that you had a fundamental change in the way the Protestant Church functioned, as far as the way it functioned as a church and in missions. And you had the beginning of Protestant missions movement from the Pietism in Germany and out of Zinzendorf, like we saw. And John Wesley converted in the Moravian meeting. And then you had, and the Pietism was heavily influenced by Puritanism, which was also going on the continent at the time. And so this week we kind of, we usher into the transition that really happened from the French Revolution into the 1800s. So you get a lot of the working out of the 1700s and the ideas in the unbelieving realm and ideas that were spreading through the church in the 1700s. They kind of come to fruition in the 1800s to varying degrees inside and outside the church. So, so here's the primary missionary movement during this time. Also, like we saw, was within the Catholic Church, within the Jesuits primarily, and then the Franciscans and Dominicans. And so you had Jesuit missions that were going out with the explorers. You had, which had varying degrees, in the Americas and then along the coast of Africa and then in Asia, you had varying degrees of conversion and discipleship in the areas, the Americas being much less, whatever, solid, and the East being a lot more solid in their theology and practice, because the West really was more dominated by more mixed motives in the situation, the search for gold and souls. And so so the age of colonialism, if you want to pull out, I assume you probably already have your timeline. I do not. I have a green one that actually works okay. Thank you. Though. So. I apologize for all the reading this week. This week is the age of colonialism, is known as the Great Century of Missions, which isn't, it's not really the Great Century of Missions, it's the Great Century of Protestant Missions. And so any missions history that we're going to read is generally Protestant missions history. And so this is the Great Century for Protestant missions. And so there's just a lot more to read as far as this week than other weeks. But again, it's gone. So again, this week, I know this is history of the World Christian Movement, but basically all I got done was, again, the introduction and Reformation areas, and then I have notes from the missions that I haven't worked through, but I'll rely mostly, as far as the history of missions, that you guys have read the Neil book, which gives a basic overview, even though I know it's really dry, but this will give, the class today will give you kind of a outline as far as what was happening in the world and in the church that gave context for the Great Century of Missions. Because it was the world scene that was happening as far as colonialism that really opened the door for the Great Century of Missions, and it was the Reformation movements, the revival movements that were happening in the church that gave, especially in America, that gave the fuel for the Great Century of Missions. So, introduction, modern colonialism. Though the end of the 18th and early 19th centuries saw the first era of European decolonialization in the Americas, and so with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars at the beginning of the 1800s, you saw a lot of the American states rebel, and because they just couldn't. Primarily, Spain couldn't keep its empire together with Napoleon occupying their home territory, and so. But the 19th century, even though there was large decolonialization and independence in the Americas, this century is really known as the greatest expansion of colonialism in history, and it's a little difficult to define. I know we talk about colonialism. Historically, there's debate as to the real difference between colonialism and imperialism. And there really isn't any difference between the two. They're both the political and economic domination of one country over another. The only real difference between colonialism and imperialism is that colonialism involves actual colonies and colonizing a foreign nation rather than just kind of establishing a governmental presence over another nation. So point two, the Napoleonic Wars directly resulted. So here's 1700. You have the Holy Roman Empire and the conglomeration of all the Germanic states, and then you have 1800, right before the Napoleonic Wars. So you have the major powers at the time of Spain, France, Germany, and England happening. The Napoleonic Wars after the French Revolution, because the French Revolution just kind of deteriorated into a mess, and then you had a young man, Napoleon Bonaparte, who rose up out of the army as a general within the army and basically established a military dictatorship, but consolidated the power and organized the ranks. Napoleon really saw himself as a a messiah in the situation, somebody who embodied the ideals of the Enlightenment, yet had the administrative power and the visionary power to establish a society based on the Enlightenment across the entire world. He really was kind of a Hitler of his day. He was a Hitler who desired to establish the highest race on the earth, across the entire earth. He was kind of the Hitler of the day, establishing the highest system of society and thought and the Enlightenment across the earth. And he just saw himself as the most able person to do it at the time. So what happened out of the Napoleonic Wars, here's Hitler's empire, and these are the empires in subjection to him as far as actual states under his control, and then these are the Prussian and the Austrian empires, and the Denmark Empire are allies to him. And so the Napoleonic Empire really was, he was on the precipice of having control over all of Europe and then moving out right out here to Moscow. And so when he set out in whatever 1812 to press out to Russia, his desire was really just to sack Moscow and then make Moscow another subject state to himself and kind of rule over the Eurasian continent. But the point of why he was doing it, some people think which he was demented and a little psychotic, but the point of what he was doing was establishing the Napoleonic Code and a system of society and rule as far as basic rights for the people. He was just doing it in something of a tyrannical way. But his code and law, the way of to run a society, as far as the Napoleonic Code, was established at this time and then proliferated throughout the world. And so historians who study as far as political science and the development of different governments across the world, it really was the Napoleonic Wars that established most of the way that modern nation states, as far as the leadership and the rights of the people, function, was from his Napoleonic Code. What happened out of this, out of Europe and all of the wars with Spain, again, because once Napoleon invaded Spain and occupied Spain, they couldn't keep their hold over the Americas, South America, and then Western North America. And Napoleon, he sold off the central part of America so that he could fund the war. And so, and this was Spain before they let it go, whatever, I forget when they sold this off. But it was the Napoleonic Wars that demanded that Europe lose control of the Americas. And it also decimated the economy and land of Central Europe in the wars. And so what came out of that was the rise of Britain. And the reason Britain became the dominant world empire during the 19th century was because of the Napoleonic Wars, and because they were somewhat shielded from everything that was going on in the mainland. So point three, in context to the Industrial Revolution, European countries sought to fulfill their insatiable appetite for more resources to produce in their factories through political colonialism, which culminated in the scramble for Africa at the end of the century, in which over 95% of the world was under colonial control of some sort. And so this is colonialism across the world, various empires ruling over. There weren't that many, just the gray ones are the ones that were just states that just ruled themselves and didn't have any other colonies associated under them. So, the Industrial Revolution began primarily driven, the colonialism was primarily driven by the Industrial Revolution, which began in Britain in the late 1700s and then spread throughout Europe and North America. And the reason for colonialism, the thing that really drove colonialism, was the drive for more resources to ship to the factories that were being produced to make more profits. And that really is the bottom line for how the world functions. And it's the bottom line for the age of globalization, really a context within which this century developed and functions. And though we don't have colonialism per se in the 20th century, it really is, it's the same bit, just in different form. Cheaper resources, cheaper labor to produce to make more profit. I mean, it's really A plus B equals C over and over, just in different forms and different treaties and different ways. So, page two, by page two, the Industrial Revolution thus birthed the modern capitalist movement, since the GDP per capita was broadly stable before the Industrial Revolution. And so this is just a chart of the world gross domestic product per capita until the Industrial Revolution. By the end of the 1800s, it starts to shoot up. And so it really was the Industrial Revolution. There was the ideology of capitalism happening in the late 1700s and early 1800s, but it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution and the potential for unlimited growth that capitalism began to really unfold. The major players in the Industrial Revolution and the capitalist movement were, number one, Great Britain. At the beginning of the 1800s, and so here's the share of world manufacturing output. You have at the beginning of the 1800s, Great Britain, far more than anybody else, because they really kind of pioneered most of the technology and the building of factories in Great Britain. And then Germany took a bunch of that technology without all the research and development, trial and error, and implemented it. And then the United States, by the end of the 1800s, really began to outpace and overtake everything. So by the end of the century, Great Britain had kind of built the world empire that ruled over about, you can think of, at the turn of the century, Great Britain ruled over about a quarter of the landmass on the planet and about a quarter of the population of the planet. And that transitioned into the 20th century, when the United States began to outpace Great Britain, and the world wars happened, and a bunch of nationalization that happened after World War I and World War II, and the United States really established themselves as the leader economically and politically. The industrialization went through two major phases, the first being steam and textiles, just as far as kind of generally thinking about the industrial revolution. There was the steam and textiles, and then the petroleum and steel. And so this machine right here that was developed in the 1860s, the Bessemer converter, and I don't know if you can tell how large it is, but here's a sign, and I'm trying to look for things that kind of give you perspective. It's a massive machine in which you have oxygen that's blown up through the heated inside where they put raw iron ore in, and they kind of blow off all of the contaminants and impurities and make steel out of it. So it was this machine that ushered in really the second phase of the Industrial Revolution and the development of steel. And so here's the steam engine, which characterized the first stage of the revolution. So you really had a massive change as far as North Atlantic society, because it was Europe and America that were dominating the economic and political movement during the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s. And what it did with the development of all these inventions and technologies is it really fueled the worldview and philosophy, the identity of the kind of mass consciousness of the society at that time. Because the invention of all these products that changed the lifestyle and changed the ability of the North Atlantic states to rule over all these other countries, it really did reinforce the way they were thinking and the ideas that were developing at the time. Well, the whole thing, see the large gears, the whole thing would flip over, whatever, it would flip over and pour out. I don't know if they would, and I've never actually seen it work, if they would flip it over, if all the impurities rose to the top, and then they would somehow get the impurities off, because they would separate out, and then they would, as they would flip it over, they would pour it into whatever casting system they had. Yeah, the thought and worldview, and I mean it really is. I don't have the chart, but your worldview really does dictate your missiology and then your sociology. And so, as the worldview developed in a way, the missiology and the sociology of Europe and America, they fed off of each other and fueled each other. And the two, it wasn't like. Because a lot of times you get history taught and it's just like, oh, people were just inventing stuff and like developing new ideas. No, they're inventing stuff to hoard and amass money and power because of the ideology and the worldview that was developing at the time, which was holistic. It really happened in a holistic way. And if you get a feel for what was happening in the 1800s as far as their worldview and their society that was developing out of it, then you get a real feel for the context out of which the missions movement developed. And if you get a feel for what was happening during the 1800s, then you get a feel for how it developed into the 1900s, and it just helps you process what's happening today with the information revolution and how it affects society as driving society, and therefore the context for the missions movement that's happening right now, and ultimately where it's going to go. Because what this school, part of the idea of this school is developing a missions program to proceed and give input about how to do missions in a coming Antichrist system and what that'll look like. And so it really is integral to understand how the world system has developed over this time period, especially during globalization, and where it's at now, to give kind of perspective and preparation so that Nazi Germany doesn't just happen to you like it happened to 90% of the church in Germany and Europe at the time. I mean, there was a small kind of contingent that saw it coming, so to say, but the goal of this school is really to give context and preparation to see it coming in a more substantial way as it comes at us. So, point C, rationalistic utopianism. This is kind of just a historical term that you had ideologies, utopian ideologies that were developing out of the naturalistic worldview during the 1800s based on rationalistic, based on purely based on human reason and ration. And so purely based on human reason, you had ideas that were envisioning a utopian society for the world that would be produced out of all the new technological innovation and governmental oversight of the world. So as the philosophical enlightenment of the 18th century transitioned into the seemingly limitless technological innovation and progress of the 19th century, Europeans began envisioning idealistic societies unhindered by the plagues of religion and tyranny. The stage for the 19th century utopianism was largely set by a man named G.F.W. Hegel. So who's familiar with Hegel? Hegel is kind of one of those guys like Newton, though he's not as well known, but it's kind of one of those scenarios where in the 1700s, everywhere you read, all roads lead back to Newton. In the 1800s, it's not as pronounced, but in a lot of ways, all roads lead back to Hegel when you study different theories in different disciplines in the 1800s. So Hegel and his major work, Phenomenology of the Spirit, he envisioned, he doesn't articulate it out this way, but this was kind of the logical deduction that everybody made, in which he viewed reality as a whole, particularly articulated as human history as a whole, was developing, and his idea of God was kind of, his God was nature expressed through the human spirit. And so the phenomenology of spirit was the development of God and kind of God consciousness, if any of you guys are familiar with Schleiermacher, that was happening also at the same time. The father of modern liberalism, but you had kind of the God consciousness, the spirit of humanity developing over history, in which you had a thesis being born, which was then countered by an antithesis, which then created a synthesis. And then that synthesis became a new thesis, then countered by an antithesis, which produced a new synthesis, on and on. And so you get this idea of kind of humanity as a whole, but it had implications in that nature or reality as a whole was functioning this way, progressing and developing forward through this kind of process. B, Hegelian philosophy, which was really more of a worldview. And so if you ever study Hegelian philosophy, it wasn't just a philosophy or idea that Hegel was putting forward. It was really an interpretation of history as a whole. And he would never articulate out like his cosmogony or his eschatology or his soteriology as far as how he saw, you know, the thesis and the antithesis and the synthesis saving humanity. He didn't really articulate a lot of that out, but the implications were drawn. And so by his interpretation of history as a whole, he really developed an integrated worldview based on the Newtonian worldview, the naturalistic worldview that preceded. And so as it spread throughout Europe and the Americas, it wasn't like it was adopted wholeheartedly. I mean, you definitely had Hegelian schools, but it was the ideas that were adopted widespread more than his philosophy in particular. Like, it was the ideas of Plato that got integrated rather than the specifics of his theory. the idea of metaphysical dualism. The same way with Freud, it was the idea of the naturalistic human person and the split between conscious and subconscious that was adopted widespread, rather than the specifics of his theory of id, ego, superego, etc. So it was the same way with Hegel. It was his idea of nature progressing as a whole that really got adopted in the 18th century, rather than his specifics of how that progression of nature happened. So he provided the framework, okay? So you had... So you had the same way that, like you saw... So the same way that you saw during the Enlightenment and the... During the Enlightenment, you saw the naturalistic framework set up by Newton, and kind of all roads led back to Newton, because guys who functioned in all these different areas, they really, the framework was given by Newton because he articulated the big picture of reality. So it's the same way Hegel really gave validation and idea of the progressive character and nature progressing as a whole within which different areas and disciplines functioned and were validated. No, the idea was definitely around, like guys like Francis Bacon really established during the Renaissance, that humanity was progressing. There were major pieces in place before the 1800s, but it was really Hegel that gave the framework for the metaphysical construct as a whole as progressing, that reality as a whole is progressing in this way through these mechanics of a thesis, antithesis, and a synthesis, that nature as a whole is functioning this way. And so once you have a metaphysical framework within which, a big picture within which to function, it validates your idea of, for example, Lyell arguing that the geological processes of the earth are progressing. And Darwin can come along and say, the biological processes of nature are progressing. And then Marx can come along and say, the economic, the sociological processes of humanity are progressing within the bigger picture of nature progressing. It's kind of, I mean, it wasn't like, and people believe that reality as a whole was progressing before Hegel, but Hegel gave the mechanics behind it. It's kind of like you believe the flood was real, and then you heard Walt Brown, and it was like, oh, now I have the mechanics. It really is real. I really can look at it like it's a real thing. And so Hegel was the one who kind of gave the mechanics for nature progressing that validated everybody else arguing for the specific areas within nature to be progressing. Does that make sense?
So can you give like an example of a thesis, then an antithesis, then a synthesis?
Well, for example, point three, you have Scottish economist Adam Smith, who was a deist, in which, just on a big picture, on page three there, he argued, they're both arguing, Karl Marx and Adam Smith, Adam Smith being the father of capitalism, Karl Marx being the father of communism. They're both arguing against divine right, okay? Adam Smith wasn't, well, whatever. They're both arguing against the divine right monarchies. One is arguing that the best way to function within for humanity to function is that there is no governmental control by the monarchies, and you just let private individuals function the way they function, it'll work out on its own. So there's a thesis. Karl Marx comes along and says, no, it's going to progress beyond that, an antithesis of there shouldn't be any private ownership, and that the government should be completely by the people, for the people. Communism is really democracy in its ideal form. I know that may seem kind of contradictory, but communism really is the ultimate logical end of democracy, in which all of the people rule themselves completely, and there is no ability for anyone else to rule over the people, except the people own everything corporately. And so you have kind of a thesis and an antithesis, and the two coming together would be limited private ownership within a corporate ownership, which would be socialism in some varying form. That's not really a very good example.
So basically, like the middle.
I'm trying to think of some of Hegel's. I remember Hegel idealized Napoleon as the. Oh, yeah, yeah. Here, this was Hegel's primary example, was that you had the thesis of the Enlightenment, you had the antithesis of the French Revolution, and then you had the synthesis of Napoleon, because he really saw Napoleon as the ideal, because he produced Phenomenology of the Spirit in 1807, really as Napoleon was gaining steam and establishing his empire. And so he really idealized Napoleon. So that was his main example. So, point four, as non-Europeans were increasingly viewed as savage races, having fallen behind in the progress of humanity, the idea of the white man's burden began to take root, especially by the end of the 1800s. A lot of your political and economic policy that was being developed was developed around this idea that the European states were much more evolved, much more civilized than all of the other nations. And so the colonialism, the political and economic policies that were being developed, a lot of it was influenced by this idea of the white man's burden, that they had to civilize all of these nations that were being colonialized, specifically in Africa at the end of the century. And so you had different, like, this is just a couple, this is an advertisement for soap. The first step towards lightening the white man's burden is through teaching the virtues of cleanliness, pear soap. And then here's a drawing of this being kind of the, oh, he actually has U.S. on there. Oh, yeah, yeah, because this was a picture of the U.S. colonizing the Marshallese and the Marshall Islands. And so this is kind of your strong U.S. explorer, or colonizer or whatever, and he's taking them up to the schoolhouse for education. They just don't understand we're made of dirt. If they understood we were made of dirt, they wouldn't be so afraid of it. This also really drove, like, for example, the idea during the mid 1800s of manifest destiny in America, in which it was the destiny based on the American Revolution and the ideals of the revolutionaries, that it was the destiny of America to gain control of the entire United States, establish a city on a hill, an ideal society from which civilization and Christianity would go forth around the world. And so here, the idea of manifest destiny really is kind of the encapsulation of what you get with Enlightenment ideals from the 1700s mixed with Christianity, specifically postmillennialism in America, produces this idea of, really played itself out in the idea of manifest destiny. And so here is, this is an angel. She's got a school book. She's got a telegraph line in her hand in which she's stretching across a telegraph. You have light behind her. You have darkness in front. You have the savage Indians in front. Dark landscape, and behind you have technology, the railroads, and the farming, and the and kind of the settlers, etc. And then back off to the east, you have the industrialization happening with the ships. So, I mean, you really get, I mean, this is kind of a famous painting, but you get in one painting the ideas that encapsulate a bunch of different movements happening together, within which the missions movement came out of all this. So it gives you context for a lot of the missions movement. And then it also really gives you context for why the great century of missions comes to an end, which we'll get there in a second. So Reformation, we'll hit this for a few minutes. Reformation, you really have... three major movements of Reformation within the 1800s. You have the Second Great Awakening. Well, I guess three to four. You have the Second Great Awakening that happens in the first half of the century, which is kind of your major revival movements that happen. Then you have the Holiness Movement that really set the stage for the Azusa Street and Pentecostalism. You have the urban revivals under D.L. Moody and such, and then you have the student volunteer movement at the end, and they're all very integrated together. And those four things really are the backdrop for the missions movement, because the Protestant missions movement really did come directly out of those things. So the beginning of the Second Great Awakening at the turn of the century was the Cane Ridge Revival. And it really was. The Cane Ridge Revival set the tone and direction of America in a lot of ways, but of the missions movement and everything that happened in the 1800s. It was just a massive turning point. So at the turn of the 19th century, you really had, just for context for the Cane Ridge Revival, everything west of the Appalachian Mountains. And so where the Cane Ridge Revival happened, which was about 40 minutes northeast of Lexington in Kentucky, it really was the frontier at the time. Lexington only had about 1,700 people living in the town at the time. And the Cane Ridge Revival attracted, at its height, about 20,000 people. And so you had a real migration and a flocking to the place, and it ended after about 3 weeks because they ran out of food, and so everything kind of shut down and everybody went home. But it was really that 3 week period on the frontier. And so on the frontier, you have a lot of different dynamics that are happening on the frontier. You have kind of the revolutionary spirit of people wanting to get out from governmental and religious tyranny. And so you had kind of the real independent folk who were trying to establish little godly, like there were groups of believers that would move across the frontier in kind of a little community, and you had pastors that were kind of mobile pastors of shepherds of communities moving across. You had just plain kind of entrepreneurial, non-believing capitalists that were moving across. They weren't really capitalists because it wasn't where the money was, but they were very entrepreneurial. You also had a bunch of kind of fugitives and people fleeing after they commit crimes. They flee over the mountains. It was just a really rough, tough environment that was happening. And so the Cane Ridge Revival was filled with these kind of people. It was led by the real independent leaders of the church, and all the converts were really rough, drunkard, etc., fugitives, and everybody in between. Page 4. In this context, you had the rise of the camp meeting. And the Cane Ridge camp meeting it really set the ideal and the standard for the camp meeting. And it was the Second Great Awakening was a camp meeting awakening, more or less. It either happened camp meeting out in the woods, or it happened camp meeting style as far as protracted meetings in urban settings, which protracted meetings meaning just extended meetings happening for a long time. The same way a camp meeting would happen for 3 or 4 weeks, and they would schedule camp meetings around the agricultural lifestyle when there wasn't a lot of work to do on the farms. They would schedule 2, 3, 4 week camp meetings to happen. And so it was that style, the camp meeting style, was integrated into urban settings with protracted meetings happening in urban settings elsewhere, which we'll get into. And it was the camp meeting that really changed the environment of the church, because the church, at the turn of the century, at the beginning of the 1800s, the Methodist Church was the smallest, because the Methodist Church didn't even come to America really until the 1780s, right after the Revolution. And it was the smallest, but by 1850, the Methodist Church was the largest church in America. The Baptist Church was the third largest church at the turn of the century. And by the 1850, it was the second largest church. The largest church in America at the turn of the century was the Congregationalist Church, a Puritan church. And by the end of the century, it was the smallest. I mean, by 1850, it was the smallest church. And it really was the camp meeting movement that led to the rise of the Methodist movement. And it's really hard to describe the Methodist movement in the 1800s was the backbone of the church in the 1800s and the backbone of the missions movement in the 1800s. And it really tailed off in the early 1900s, but the 1800s, the Methodist movement and all of the offshoots that came out of it really was the backbone for the Reformation and the expansion of the church. So the camp meeting movement was mostly a Methodist and Baptist movement with Presbyterianism, but the way the Presbyterian movement functioned as far as its leadership kind of led to its eventual downfall, however you want to say that. So back on track. So the Cane Ridge Revival was organized by a couple Presbyterian ministers in conjunction with a couple Methodist ministers outside of Lexington. And Barton Stone and James McGrady, they say James McGrady was so ugly, that's why you can never find a picture of him, that he was so ugly nobody ever took a picture of him and nobody wanted to look at him. But they were the two guys that organized it. It was originally meant to be a 6-day meeting, but it turned into over 3 weeks. I just put on here, there's a couple different descriptions of the Cane Ridge Revival. Here's a picture of a Kentucky camp meeting. And it gives you kind of an idea where they would cut out an area in the trees, make a kind of shed for the preaching to happen, and then put out a bunch of logs and areas for people to sit. And so this is actually a picture, an old picture drawn of the Cane Ridge Revival. And there's a few different descriptions of the revival. The most famous was by a young skeptical reporter, James Finley, who was converted at the meeting and went on to lead a number of other camp meetings. And so in footnote number 9, I just wanted to read that and we'll take a break. But it gives you a feel of what the Cane Ridge Revival was like. So the noise was like that of Niagara. The vast sea of human beings seemed to be agitated as if by a storm. I counted 7 ministers, all preaching on stumps, others in wagons, and one standing on a tree. Some of the people were singing, others praying, some crying for mercy in the most piteous accents, while others were shouting most vociferously. While witnessing these scenes, a particularly strange sensation, such as I had never felt before, came over me. My heart beat tumultuously, my knees trembled, my lips quivered, and I felt as if I must fall to the ground. A supernatural power seemed to pervade the entire mass of mind there collected. I stepped up on a log where I could have a better view of the surging sea of humanity. The scene that had presented itself to my mind was indescribable. At one time, I saw at least 500 swept down in a movement as if a battering ram ran, a battery of 1,000 guns had been opened upon them, and then immediately followed shrieks and shouts that rent the very heavens. And so it was a wild scene, to say the least. Actually, let's go ahead and cover the Yale Revival. About the same time, you had deism spreading through the Northeast in a real prevalent way, and the church declining in numbers and fervor. And then you had the grandson of Jonathan Edwards became the president of Yale, which was originally founded as a Christian college and kind of missions training school, but as deism took over and all the faculty became deist, it quickly moved away from that. But Jonathan Edwards' grandson became president, and everybody had to take Timothy Dwight's theology class, and it was in his theology class in 1802 that you had kind of a movement of the Spirit and a mass conversion of all the students in that class, which spread to the whole campus. And then from Yale, it spread to a number of other colleges throughout the Northeast, one of which was Williams College, where a young man, Samuel Mills, was a student. And he and 4 other guys met weekly, had a heart for missions. They met on the in a field outside of the college. And one day in 1806, it started raining real heavy. They sought shelter under a large haystack and were praying there and committed themselves to missions for the rest of their lives. Those 5 students all went to Andover Seminary, and at Andover Seminary, that's where they formed the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Mission, which was the first student missions organization in history, but was really the origin of the American missions movement. So let's take a break there, and we'll come back and kind of move into the urban revivals of the Second Great Awakening.